Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 187 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is May Pang, John Lennon's companion and romantic partner for about a year and a half period that has come to be known as Lennon's Lost Weekend. That phrase is a misnomer in that this time wasn't particularly lost for Lennon. For one, he actually was productive, promoting his Mind Games album, recording his albums Walls and Bridges and Rock and Roll, and producing Harry Nilsson's Pussycats. Also, despite some public nightclub embarrassments and the implied overlap with the 1945 Billy Wilder movie, The Lost Weekend, Pang says Lennon wasn't on a constant bender. She also says he wasn't personally lost, even though this was the one period when he was separated from his wife, Yoko Ono. The way Pang sees it, he may have even been happy. For anyone schooled in Beatles lore, the details of the setup are well known. May Pang, a young New Yorker and the daughter of Chinese immigrants, worked in the office of Alan Klein, who was managing the three Beatles not named Paul. Pang was in her early 20s and 10 years younger than Lennon, and she eventually became John and Yoko's assistant. Pang and Ono both have described how Yoko, fearing that an unhappy John was about to stray in their marriage, instructed Pang to become his lover when John showed interest. He did, and soon Lennon and Pang were a couple, with Ono checking in on them almost constantly. During this period from late 1973 through early 1975, Lennon and Pang hopscotched between New York and Los Angeles, where he palled around with a party-hardy Nilsson and a crowd of so-called Hollywood vampires that included Ringo Starr and Keith Moon. Pang helped to foster Lennon's reunion with his son Julian and was there when Lennon and Paul McCartney reconnected after years of acrimony. As she recounts, she and John visited with Paul and Linda McCartney multiple times in L.A. and New York. John considered writing with Paul again and planned to travel with Pang to New Orleans, where McCartney was about to record what would have become the album Venus and Mars. But that was the road not taken. John's return to Yoko didn't end Pang's relationship with him or the rock world. Years later, she was married to and had two children with Tony Visconti, who produced David Bowie, T-Rex, and many others. She also wrote the 1983 memoir Loving John, narrates and stars in the 2022 documentary The Lost Weekend, A Love Story, and is currently touring her photo exhibit capturing her years with John, also called The Lost Weekend. In this emotionally charged conversation, May Pang recalls producer Phil Spector's out-of-control behavior during the rock and roll sessions, details the night she and John saw a UFO from their New York City balcony, and reflects on songs such as the first one John wrote for her. She makes me sweat. One in which she whispers his name, and others that would appear years later, such as Beautiful Boy and the recent Beatles release Now and Then. She also reveals which question she is asked by fans the most, and she asserts forcefully why she thinks it's important that people know her story. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with May Pang. So you're in New York City, I assume?
Yeah, I am. If I seem a little lethargic, I'm still tired, but I just, you know, the last couple of days, it's all these bad news of people that have just passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The yesterday I got, what was it, Lou Christie.
I saw that.
Yeah, he was a very, very dear friend of mine. And so it really hit me hard on that one.
Oh, I'm really sorry. Yeah, that's one of the Lightning Strikes is one of the all-time great singles ever, too. So
absolutely. I mean, John knew it. He used to say, "Oh, there's Lightning Lou," you know, and whatever. But it was such a shock to me when I got the news from Scott, you know, who dealt with it. And I said, "What are you talking about?" And when he mentioned it, and I just sort of like went, "Oh my God, no, can't be."
No.
So once, you know, it was like we were looking to be sure that it's real, because you know how many of those, oh, they're dead. And then you find out, no, they're not, you know. So, and I just spoke to him not that long ago, and he said, "We got to get together for dinner." I said, "Sure."
So this was a surprise.
Oh, absolutely. did not know he was even ill. I think I said to Scott, how did you find out? And he said that he read somewhere where it was Fabian. Remember Fabian?
Right.
And they would go out and perform. And he says, I didn't know he was even ill. So I said, if you found it that Fabian said something, then I'm sure that it's more likely that it's true, which none of us wanted it to be.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. A lot of people, whether they knew him personally or not, I'd met him a few times, but like Brian Wilson, even though he'd been, you know, like not in great shape for a while, it's still one of those just like passages of time where like you lose legends like him and Sly Stone 2 days apart, and you're just like, oh, you know.
I mean, someone just said they're all 82.
Yeah.
So that was like, remember, it used to be 27, now it's 82, so.
Right. Paul turned 83 yesterday, so.
Right. So didn't even have time to write anything about him when I was so focused on Lou, because I'm, you know, even though I know Paul, it's not even that, you know, Lou was just so close to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. Are you still up for talking about this?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, I don't want to.
All right. Well, great to meet you. You know, the phrase lost weekend always sort of struck me as like a weird one, because it sort of implies like this kind of the sort of drunken haze, if you take the, you know, the movie The Lost Weekend, and B, that somehow it wasn't productive, it was lost, and yet it was very productive, right? So like, does that phrase bother you?
You know, it used to bother me, and I decided, let me just take hold of it, because when people start to read it, people are confused by it. When he was once asked about, oh, what it was like when you were out with Harry Nilsson and all this stuff, and, you know, you were always drunk and you know, in clubs and everything. He goes, yeah, it was a long lost weekend. You know, it's like he used to use the metaphors, and he loved old movies. And of course, there's one old movie. It was called The Lost Weekend.
Sure.
About a guy, yeah, with Ray Milland. And then I believe that's who it was. And That's how he saw it. But everybody took it to be that it was my weekend with him and it was about me and him, but when it wasn't. So I decided, well, I'm going to have to change it after a while. So what I did after, you know, years of everybody trying to make it that and hanging on me and say, that's the reason it was you, you know, and I said, I don't think so.
Well, and obviously the movie is called The Lost Weekend, a love story, you know, so people know that. I didn't associate the lost part as much with you as it did to this notion that he was somehow, like, again, on this bender for 18 months.
Right, and he wasn't.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because like the movie, you know, that you talk about, you know, the thing of the troubadour, especially the second one with Tommy, with the Smothers Brothers.
That's what I'm saying. Everybody kept going back to the same thing over and
right.
If you repeat it, it's the press that keeps doing, the media keeps repeating, oh, he was so drunk. I keep saying, if he was that drunk, how could he produce all that music? Because that was not it, you know, and it really was trying to come back out, and because I got tired of everybody else telling me what was actually happening. I said, you weren't there. You don't know what was happening, and that's not how it went.
Well, and you're someone who, as you've said, did not drink and was not doing drugs. So I would think that, you know, if he was doing that all the time and you weren't at all, that wouldn't have really worked out for all that time.
No, and I don't. That's one thing about John. He loved being in the studio working. He couldn't create the music that he was doing. You know, that's the other thing. You would the one time that it was a little definitely out of control was when Phil Spector came in to play, and it was so difficult because Phil took control. John just wanted to. It came after we did Mind Games. John said, "I just want to be a singer in the band. So all I want to do is just do some music. Don't want to think about being producer. Don't want to think about anything else. Just get everybody into the room. Let me sing and let me walk away." And the next album was supposed to be all this rock and roll, which would have been perfect with Phil as, you know, the producer.
Right. The classic producer of old time rock and roll.
Absolutely. Well, needless to say, we had, and, you know, Phil kept saying, "You're definitely giving me the control." And right there, it started to, you know, get into my bones. I'm going, something's wrong. I don't like that. He was in control. The first night, we only knew only a couple of the musicians. The one thing that was agreed upon that John said, I'll let you do it out here in L.A. So we stayed out in L.A. He wanted the recording, the same recording studio, his own engineer and everything. We said, John said, no. He said, I want my guy. You have everything else, but I want my guy there. He knows me. So that was Roy Sakala from the record plant in the on the East Coast, because that's where we did a lot of our records and recordings. And he was the owner. He was like the granddaddy of teaching all the engineers there. So Phil said, okay, we'll let you, you know. That was the one thing he let John have. And so we had flown Roy out, and the person he brought with him was a very inexperienced at the time, a young Jimmy Iovine, because all the other engineers, assistant engineers, were all already all booked. So he couldn't, nobody else can come out. So he came out with Roy, and he was being taught on the spot, as it were.
Wow.
Yeah.
Little knowing that he would become a very famous, successful producer. But that's sort of I guess it's a good thing that he stuck with it after that experience.
Well, I don't think he wanted to leave. I think, you know, Roy made sure, you know, it was kind of interesting for him. And it worked. And he would always look up to John and says, what do you think? He used to call him Doc. Hey, Doc, you know, what do you think? You know, so it was great. Like, for instance, when we did the Walls and Bridges, that was 8 weeks from start to finish. John was so proud of that. I mean, from the minute he walked into the studio, Roy Sakala, but it was Al Corey from Capitol Records said, I just negotiated. I finally got the tapes back, because a lot of people knew that Phil had taken our tapes and we couldn't finish that rock and roll right away.
Right.
And so John says, well, I can't listen to it now. My head's in another zone. So put those tapes away till later. And we didn't do those until towards the end of the 74. And that's right. when we went back to it. But doing the Walls and Bridges was great, because he was so into it. He just said, let's go. He used to tell the band, I don't care what you do, whatever recreation you want to do, but after we finish the day, you could do whatever you want, but not before.
Stay focused.
Yeah, because he said, it's so hard to be learning new songs if you're already hot. So he didn't want that. He says, I don't care what you do after.
And that's not what the sessions for rock and roll were like, I take it.
No, because Phil had provided liquor. And I said to John, why is there liquor in the studio? You know, there was liquor to be had at the table. And I'm sitting there going, I don't understand, because we never had any of those things. So he goes, I don't know. And Phil drank a bottle of Courvoisier a night.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot.
When the gun
will go down.
When the gun came out, that probably was the final straw.
Well, that was later on, actually. That was much later on, and it was at Record Plant West Studio. We got already thrown out of A&M because of all of Phil's antics and everybody else. We didn't even know what happened. Next thing you know, we're in another studio. So we were on the we were at Record Plant, and I heard the gun go off, and I went, I'm such a New Yorker. I went, what is that? I'm running towards the sound. Everybody's ducking. I'm the only stupid one that's like, I'm going to run towards that sound. But standing next to me was Mother Bertha. It was Phil's mother who was standing next to me.
What?
It was wild. Yeah.
So he's like firing his gun off with his mom there?
No. Well, his mother was in the other, with me in the recording studio. And Phil was in the guest lounge with Mal Evans, you know, and John, when it went off. And I opened the door, and, you know, there's Phil with the gun in his hand, and John with the finger in his ear going, Phil, if you're going to shoot me, you know, that type of thing. And Mal says, give me that gun. You don't, you know, it's dangerous. And I'm standing going, what just happened? And Mouse says, oh, you know, we were just horsing around. And I just asked Phil to stop doing it because it was hurting me. And, you know, it was something they were doing, but it was hurting Mal's nose. And he said, can you just not do that? And Phil didn't like that. He didn't take it too kindly. And he said, you can't tell me what to do type of thing. And he backed up. And as he reached for the holster, the gun goes off.
Did aside from all that, did you and John think those sessions were going well musically? Or was it all kind of like, did that all just kind of spill over into, oh, I'm not sure about this record. This is just a little too chaotic.
We were hoping, I think we were hoping it sounded good. We weren't sure because, you know, we were still trying to figure out the songs. But we didn't know at the time that Phil was taking all these tapes home also and how it was being recorded. Because, you know, he has his only way of recording because of the wall of sound, which I now understand how it's done. And that's why when our record of Rock and Roll came out, it was difficult and people didn't understand why we didn't use all the songs that John had and to put it on the record. And if you really listen to it, you could hear the difference between the Phil produced as
opposed absolutely.
Against the John produced straight, you know, everybody hears Stand By Me. That's a John produced.
Absolutely.
You know? And then when you hear, you know, what was it? The other songs, Just Because or whatever.
Or like Be My Baby and Sweet Little 16.
But that's later. We took that off. That's why it wasn't on the original first go round.
Yeah. But like those are like pretty, like the Spectre ones are pretty weird.
One of the things we couldn't do was we couldn't take the vocals and isolate them. And John wanted to try and make that. But what happens in recording Phil's, the way Phil records for his wall of sound, everybody's in the same room.
Huh.
So when you're trying to say, let's do an overdub, ain't possible. So we had a hard time. So John was trying to be clever and he took the best of the lot. And then we recorded like four or five brand new songs.
Interesting. Yeah. And then Walls and Bridges came out before Rock and Roll because you guys went to New York and finished that up.
Well, we went to New York. We lived in New York. Everybody, that's the other thing. Everybody thought we moved to LA. We never moved to LA. We were always in New York, but all the antics happened to be in LA. So everybody thought we lived there.
Right.
Nobody ever knew. We just kept flying back and forth.
You're in Lou Adler's house.
Yes. That was arranged by Andrew Lou Goldham.
And then there's a reference to it and a clip from it in the movie, the Toot and a Snore, which is the famous jam session with Paul showing up and Linda and Stevie Wonder. And
but that's not at that house. We've already long gone out of there.
That's when you guys are still in LA though.
But no, you don't understand. We keep coming flying back.
So you've flown back to LA for something like that. It's not like you were sort of like during this long period you spent in LA.
No.
The Lost Weekend was not mostly in LA, and people think, oh, yeah, you're in LA.
Well, because everything seemed to have happened in LA because John was the new kid on the block. Okay. And so everybody wanted to see, hey, let's see what he can do, you know? So that's what happened. But we went out there for a couple of weeks just to see, and then we saw Phil, let's do a new record. Yeah, okay. But in between, we kept flying back home to New York and going out again. So we were never just in LA for the same time. We would stay out there for a length of time, but we would fly back. So all of month of July before doing Harry's album, we were in New York. Before that, I was back in New York, and we kept flying back a few times in New York. See, that's what I'm saying. It's the way it's been presented, and we were not always in L.A., but it just sounded like we were there for forever.
Right. Well, and then you have like stuff like, you know, people talking about the Vampire Club or whatever it was. And, and again, Harry Nilsson, he was a bad influence and they were drinking all the time and, doing drugs together and stuff.
Definitely. When Harry came calling, it was a nightmare for me and for any other wives or girlfriend when he would come calling. But at the same time, John finally said to Harry, listen, I can't work with you on your vocals because during the day you're at the doctor's at the acupuncture that I want you to go to. By the nighttime, you're already, you know, a tooting and snoring out the door, and it's now getting bad. So we can't do that. So they actually came back to New York to do the vocals. So it wasn't like it was done in all in L.A.
Are you talking about for Pussycats or for?
Yeah, for yeah. Pussycats. We didn't do it all in L.A. We were only there for 3 weeks for the rhythm, you know, sessions. And when we had Ringo, we had Keith Moon. It was only like 3 weeks or whatever about that. And John brought him back to New York to work and overdubbed.
Well, and he really kind of ripped up his vocal cords on that, right?
Well, I couldn't believe it. That's why John said he didn't want him to be there, because he said, this is ridiculous. He wanted him to work and finish the album, but he didn't want him to be hurting his vocal cords, which he was doing. We couldn't stop him. That's his haunt. That was his home ground.
Yeah, and I love the idea that John, during that period, was kind of able to sort of enjoy like life without having to make statements all the time and without having to be serious all the time, even though when he was serious, he still had that wit. But it sort of seems like there's a sort of, and maybe you just associate this with LA anyway, but there's kind of a relaxation, like he gets to sort of kick back a little bit after having been in this pressure cooker for so long.
Well, you know what, people, it's a relationship. So my household, as I would say, my relationship with him was not that type of relationship. I wasn't out to do any, back then, doing marches and things. Those were not my thing. I just wanted to enjoy the music, and that's what John wanted to do, was enjoy the music that he was producing or having fun seeing his friends again. It was a whole total different feel. That was our relationship. What he had with Yoko is another. You know, that we have two different ways of our lives we're heading.
Right. And would you two just like sit around listening to music at home? I mean, I would always read things about how like he loved, you know, the Ann Peebles, Can't Stop the Rain.
Yeah, we would have friends, you know, that worked like Tony King and said, oh, you got to hear this. So they would bring it over and we sit around, we hear certain things. Yeah. And I mean, that record was off the chart, came up at what, 98, 99 or whatever, fell off the chart. Nobody even heard it. And it wasn't until, you know, John was working on the promotion of doing Mind Games, and they would always ask at all the radio station, what are you listening to? And he goes, I just heard a new record. This sounds great. And he would plug the Ann Peebles song, I Can't Stand Rain, and another one, I Can Help by Billy Swan. Those were the two records that were off the chart. Came up, like I said, it was like 98, both of them in that 98, 99 fell off, and they both came back to be number one.
Right. I remember him, it was probably a little earlier, I remember reading that he really liked Dave Edmunds, I Hear You Knockin' also.
Oh yeah, he liked that sound too. I mean, you know, we just listened to whatever, and of course back then it's radio in the car.
But what was it like seeing him and Paul sort of reunite after all that time?
It was like as if nothing ever happened, you know. I just looked up and as Paul and Linda walked through the door, they just talk normal, nothing different. But that was the, in my exhibition that I do, I have one of the last photos of John and Paul together. It's framed just them two. It's not the last time that they saw each other, but it's the last time that they were ever photographed together.
Right.
In our house and back in New York, they were always at our home.
You know, I mean, obviously they had a history together and they also had like a pretty difficult period for a couple of years there, but they were cordial with each other.
They were very cordial. I mean, like I said, Paul and Linda used to come over to our home all the time. And this is in New York. I know this is like everybody keeps thinking we lived in L.A. We didn't live in L.A. We didn't like to live in L.A. That's the thing. We never liked living there. We didn't mind going there for the projects to do what we have to do. But we didn't want to live there. We never did.
You were New Yorkers.
Absolutely.
The shirt he was photographed wearing says New York City, not Los Angeles.
So that's correct. And that was something that Bob Gruen threw at him when we were doing the show. In fact, those pictures were taken on our rooftop where we lived.
Right. Is that the same rooftop where you saw the UFO?
Yes.
That's like an amazing story. So what did this UFO look like? Like, what did you see?
It was a round saucer. That's what you normally see. I just was like, what? And I just kept saying to him, what am I seeing here? You know? And I'm screaming. And, you know, it's dead of summer on a Friday night in August. And where we lived, it's a little exclusive. A lot of people go away. You know, they go to the Hamptons.
Right. Everyone goes to the Hamptons there.
Yeah. So I look up and I'm screaming, it's a UFO. No one, not my neighbors that could come out to listen to, you know, they're at the next level below me. No one's home. I look across the street. Not one person is home. Every window is dark. And this is like 9 o'clock at night and I'm screaming, it's a UFO, you know, and there's no sound to this thing. It was only about three stories above our heads.
Wow.
It's very close. So I could see the heat waves, you know, that you see on the street, you know, when it's hot and you can see those lines, all throughout underneath this UFO, the ship, whatever you want to call it. And this bright white light going around the rim, going on and off, just going around. And then one red light on top. And you could see, the color of the ship, maybe it's more like a gunmetal, you know, dark gray, what you expect. It's just dark.
See, if this were happening now, people would be going on, you know, Twitter and social media and
yes,
taking pictures of it, and they would be debating it and stuff. But here you guys are like alone on this balcony at the top of this New York building, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world. But you're like, hello, everyone. You know, we're seeing this thing.
Oh, yeah. And the first thing everybody kept saying, well, first thing is when we called people, the first thing they said is, did May see it as well? And they said, could we talk to her? Because they knew I'd be like, is it real? Or, you know, did I see it? When he saw it first, he said he was taking it all in, and he realized, he goes, May's not going to believe me. I better call her out as well. So I get called out there, and I'm looking at this thing, and he goes, and I'm screaming, and I'm looking at it, and he goes, you're seeing what I'm seeing.
Hmm.
I said, yeah, but there's no noise. I could hear the street below me, and I'm like 14 floors up, 13 floors up, you know, in the building, but I could hear across the river. I could hear the car sounds from the downstairs below on the street, but not this thing that was directly over my head. Nothing.
And did you ask around, like, afterwards, like, hey, did you guys see that?
Yep. Well, we asked. What we did was we had somebody call different places, and a few of the police station, one of them said they had seen something that was unusual, and it was coming down. They were living in the 80s. We lived in the 50s, and they in the 80s by the river. And that's, we lived by the river, but only in the 50s. So obviously it was just coming down on that, you know, that line.
How did that experience affect you guys?
Well, I think we were just excited, you know, on the Walls and Bridges, you see that John actually wrote that because I saw a UFO. And I think that I always believed, and I, you know, you always want to believe that there's got to be somebody else. I mean, how stupid can we be to think that there'd be nobody else out there in another universe? If you just think that we are the only people ever to be around, I'm sorry, I don't buy that one. You know, we're here. How did we get here? So somebody else in another universe. I truly believe there is something. But John was always fascinated by you know, UFOs and other things. And in fact, I have some of his booklets that he used to order and buy.
Yeah. He has a line about it, and Nobody Told Me later, I think.
Yeah. Like, and, you know, and we saw it together and we watched it and we were like, oh my God, the thing was flying. And I mean, we both stood there and watched this thing go from side to side, turn sideways, fly below rooftop. And he was screaming, it's flying below a rooftop. I said, I know. We couldn't believe it. And yet nobody was home. Wherever they was flying, nobody. was around.
Wow.
And I'm screaming to the top of my lungs. Not one person came out.
So I have to ask this as a cat person. Is this when you had major and minor?
Yeah, we had major and minor.
I have a blind.
Was a big cat person. John was a big cat person. And he named them for the keys of the piano.
Right. Yeah, I have a black cat and a white cat too, but they're not named that. But they do this kind of yin yang thing where they curl up together and it really looks
like
they're
that. Brother and sister. They were actually brother and sister. They were from the same litter. So the white one, the female, she was the loudmouth, but she had the best personality. So she was there and she had a little bit of black on top of her head. And the black was tuxedo, you know, with the white under his neck. They were great.
Are there any songs that you hear that especially have, like, that even now you have an emotional reaction to, either in a positive way or a negative way?
I don't have anything as a negative, you know, because his songs, that's him, that's his emotions at that moment. But I guess the positive is always, during my time, I'm hearing all these great songs that he had written or whatever he was writing, his feelings, and how fast he could do it. And obviously, I have two songs that were very close to me. The first one is the Surprise, Surprise, Sweet Bird of Paradox.
Right. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, that he wrote for me. And I was in shock more than anything else. He goes, sit down, and he says, let me play this for you. And then I realized he's written a song for me. And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't even know how to take it. So that's that. The second one, of course, is Number 9 Dream, which he had me whisper, you know, and a lot of people didn't know that. The voice on that whispering of his name is actually me. I was whispering and I sing along with him and two other people, Laurie Burton and Joey Dambra, and we do the background vocals as well, singing the chorus lines.
Right. And that's one of his most beautiful songs, too. So that's a good one to be on.
It's kind of funny because Walls and Bridges is the first song to be written for that album. You know, it just happened, was the song that he wrote for me. That's the first song. And the second and the last song to be written is Number 9 Dream.
Oh, so he did that after Whatever Gets You Through the Night.
Yeah, that was done. That was like the last song as he was writing it. That came to him in a dream, you know, and he started writing it, and that was the last song.
I used to go to these record conventions when I was in high school, and I had like this record of like alternative Walls and Bridges versions, and some of them ended up on that Men Love Avenue that came out later. But it was like a completely different approach to those. Were those, I should have looked this up, but I just thought of it. Was there like kind of a different approach to that album at first, and then he kind of regrouped? Because it didn't take that long to make the record overall.
No, it was only 8 weeks, like I said, from start to finish, which he was very proud of, and he was within budget and the whole thing. I think the thing with him was that he was never sure which way he would take. He had several approaches. So, you know, so what you're hearing is that he throws them down on cassette and he sings one way and then he comes back and he goes, let me try it this way. You know, so he didn't, what he loved was at that time, Sony had put out a cassette player that you could record because before that was only playback. And so when he found out he could record, he didn't have to keep all of this, I guess all that, the way to do things in his brain. It was taking up too much space for him. And this way he would just do a cassette, sing into it, and then say, okay, I'll come back to it. You know, it's just one right after the other.
Right.
And that's why there's all these different various versions. And I remember he'd say, let me see if I like it this way. Should I play fast? Should I do it slower? Should I, you know, it's his tryout when he hears all of it.
Yeah, and you had this period, I guess it would have been 74, where like all four Beatles were on the charts with their own songs at that point. And he
got a chance to see all of them.
And he hit number one, which he'd been sort of waiting to do.
Right. But the number one album, I mean, how great can that be? He was so shocked. It was wonderful.
Yeah, as a music fan, and again, I'd read this before, but seen it in the documentary, that the idea that he was thinking of maybe writing with Paul again, and you guys are going to go down to New Orleans, it's sort of like, oh, you know, if that had happened, you know, what's the alternative universe, you know, path that would have been followed on that.
It was amazing because because Paul and Linda had just come over, and this was in 75. So they had come over and he says, what's going on? He goes, we're going to go down to New Orleans. We're going to do the new record down there. He goes, oh, great. And this is after the dissolution of the Beatles had been signed.
So right.
That's over. So, Paul says, oh, yeah, we're going to go down to New Orleans. And John's going, New Orleans, because he wanted to go. Now it was like piqued his interest. So, the next day or the day after, all I remember is I'm working on something, had my back to him, and he's sitting on the bed, you know, twiddling around with his guitar. And he says, I got to ask you something. And I said, yeah, what is it? And I'm not looking at him. You know, I have my back to him. He goes, do you think I should write with Paul again? And like The Exorcist, my head spun around. And I said, Of course you should. And then he went, why? I said, you know, the two of you solo, you're good. But when the two of you write together, that goes beyond. You know, that's not, you know, and I'm telling him, he goes, he's sitting there and he goes, yeah, I guess you're right. And he said, maybe we should go. I said, fine. I knew that if I got him down there, that it would take place, that the two of them would write. He wanted to go so badly.
I mean, I realize this is like, I mean, this is part of your story, but it's a very personal part of it. Like, what do you think happened at that point?
Why he didn't go?
Yeah. And why? And
he went back to Yoko.
Right. But like, why did that happen at that moment? Like of all times, and watching your film, it really sounds like it's sort of out of the blue, and this idea that, oh, she's allowing me to come back, and you're just like, what?
That's not how it happened.
Yeah.
You know, I know that's the storyline.
Right.
That's what it is. Because the last words, as he was saying, as he was walking out the door, was, let's get the tickets, let's get the plane tickets so we can go down to New Orleans, and we'll go out to dinner tonight to discuss. And I said, okay.
But it's almost like there are these sort of two futures in front of him, or two doors, and one of them is you two are going down to New Orleans and you're going to spend time with Paul and maybe they're going to write together and this whole other thing could happen. Or he kind of goes back and through this other door and goes back to where he was like 2 years earlier.
That's why I said this is something, it's much deeper than what I can explain here, so I'm not going to.
Okay. But, I mean, certainly watching the film, it's like, it's kind of the story of, like, you know, for you, like a broken heart and sort of the mysteries of that. And I don't expect you to be able to explain it, because that's why they're mysteries, but.
Yeah. And, you know, in fact, that John and I actually never, it never ended, because he called all the time and tried to come and see me all the way up until the time he died.
And you two still would see each other.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, so I know it's a mystery and why, but that's something that will have to be dealt with later on. I'm not going to, because it's a little more complicated than just say, well, this is what happened.
Yeah. Well, and again, he had these five years before he recorded anything again. And
a lot of those songs were already written.
Interesting. Which ones did you already know?
Well, no, he changed the lyrics. He called me up and he said, you know, I changed the lyrics, you know, because he was talking about publishing. He said, if I leave it, I'm going to, you know, it would have been taking place in a previous publishing. And he wanted the publishing in the new arrangements.
Got it.
So he rearranged it. And, you know, there was a song called Tennessee, which, of course, came out later, you know, from the cassettes. Tennessee Williams was one of his favorite playwright, and that's what it was about. And you know, he just kept writing, and then he would change, like Beautiful Boy. A lot of people don't know how that came about. I mean, he already had the music, because I was watching Chinese opera. And he's going, what the hell are you watching? And, you know, that was cable at the time. And I said, well, this brings me back to my childhood, my family. I used to watch all this stuff. And he goes, oh, my God. And he shakes his head. And then all of a sudden he started to hear the music behind it. And he loved the bells that you could hear.
Right.
And so he was just listening to it. He goes, oh. And that's when he created the music already, the groundwork for that, for that. But he had no lyrics. So,
yeah.
Of course, that later became Beautiful Boy, but the music he had.
Right. And the music is gorgeous. And it does have that, you could, I could hear now, and you said, when you said, right when you said Chinese opera, I heard those sort of bell-like tones. Yeah. And I'm like, okay.
So that's where it came from.
Yeah. I mean, my impression was that he was going to do another album after Walls and Bridges, and Tennessee was going to be on that.
Oh, there was a whole bunch. Yeah. There was a lot. He had about another, I would say probably another five in the can somewhere, you know? So, you know, it was on that level. You know, then there's a lot of things that happened. A lot of the songs, he was very creative. He was very productive doing all the different things. I mean, when they went, when I'm sure, you know, what was it when Mick Jagger, when he did Too Many Cooks and, you know, John produced that part of it, they didn't know where to look. They were looking for the tapes. And they went everywhere, but I had them.
Mm. Why do you think he didn't, you know, release any music for 5 years?
That is not for me. I think that's something that, you know, Yoko used to say back in the day, you know, that he didn't have to do it when, you know, if he didn't want to. And I'm sure, you know, being a new father at that point, you know, probably took his time or whatever. But I know the part of him that he just loved being in the studio and still record.
Right.
Being with his friends. I mean, that's when you got a chance to see, he got a chance to see everybody. He was hanging out with everyone. I mean, we met everybody from Elton John, which we met him on my birthday in 73. So that was then. So Elton to David Bowie. You know, we saw Jagger was another, a friend that would always come around to our home all the time. So there was, and we were about to buy a house. So there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah. I didn't realize till later that that's actually John's voice, the one that goes, fame, fame, fame.
Yeah.
Fame.
No, that was done by a thing. The only thing he does is the answer.
Oh, so that, but I thought somehow his was the one that was getting manipulated too.
No, the manipulation was, from what I understand, because I asked John about that, and he said he had a thing that, one of those machines that could, that changed the voice until he got fame, 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 fame,
right.
And then went down. That was Bowie. I asked him about that.
Interesting. Okay, so this has cleared up another thing for me. Thank you. And obviously you stayed in that world. I mean, you were married to, you know, Bowie's, Bowie's producer.
I got associated with David Bowie.
Tony Visconti. So that's, I mean, we don't have to talk about that marriage, but that was a long marriage. You have two kids from that, and
yes.
And so you were still in that world. You know, it wasn't like you sort of parachuted into the rock and roll world and then we're out of that world.
No, it took a long time for me to get back into that world or to get a job, because I was told that I was sort of semi blacklisted.
Hmm.
And I was told by one of the record company execs.
Was this because people wanted to get in good with John and Yoko, and so
it was more getting in John? Yes, they wanted John because his contract was coming up and he would be a free agent. And Yoko, at that point, and a lot of people didn't realize, Yoko did not manage John until after John went back. It was not before that.
Right.
You know, everybody kept saying, oh, she managed it. She didn't.
How much did astrology factor into all of this stuff?
That's more for her than it was for him. We didn't do any of that stuff.
But you would like to sort of hear calls about, like, oh, the timing's not right for this or that. And you probably
would
were like,
do that. I mean, she called us every day. I mean, every day. I mean, it was like, it was anywhere from one call to 15 calls, depending on the day.
So would he just talk to her every time? Or was there ever a point where he was like, you know what, could we take a break?
He actually did. And she got upset. She called me back and said, why did you let that phone call go to him if he's in such a bad mood. I said he wasn't.
It sounds like very complicated and fraught. So
that's why I'm saying it's not something that everybody thinks that it's that easy to be said. It isn't.
Sure.
There was a lot going on in the background. And one day.
And you really got John back together with Julian, and the relationship between you and Julian is very sweet. And he's, you know, at the end, you're sort of coming up on his interview and you two of you are walking off together.
He had no idea I was going to be there. So he just thought he was doing that. And then I came up from behind him, and his mother and I became very, very close. And that was great. I mean, you know, we stayed in touch and I helped her out many times later on, you know, and, when she needed, you know, it was kind of what she wrote. She goes, when she needed a friend, I was there for her. I, you know, that was just me. She needed a friend, you know, so.
And the two of you could relate to some of the, you know, yes, some stuff that you'd gone through, some of the dark side, you know, of John as well as the, you know, the happy stuff.
Yeah, we knew exactly. We would say, oh, can you believe, yeah, how about this? You know, we could relate to it. We knew exactly what was happening, you know, and it's like some of the people would say, I know Sin believes this, do you? And I would say, yeah. And she goes, but I don't get it. You know, you have to be there to understand what we were facing.
Sure. But yeah, and you're still in touch with Julian, it sounds like.
Yeah, every so often, you know, I don't stand in his way. He's, you know, he's an older gentleman now, and he could do a lot of things. And it's so wonderful that he's a photographer himself. He has such great talent for singing and it's wonderful, you know, and I'm happy for him.
When you do these shows and you're meeting people, what do they ask you the most?
What was John like?
Yeah, that's a quick one. Fill in the blank.
Fill in the blank. It's really, and I stand there and I go, it's not an easy one. It really isn't, because he would always say, I'm like a chameleon. Or is it a chameleon, he would say. I don't know which way to pronounce it. But, you know, and that's the way it was. But definitely it was not an easy one. You know, when somebody says, what was he like? You know, it's like... He was everything.
That's, yeah. What is he like is about as open-ended as anything could possibly be. And honestly, if they're running into you, there's probably some context they could get some sense of it from your point of view, from your photos or your, you know, whatever
it is
that you're doing.
I've actually had people say to me, after you've seen some of the photos, I don't know if you've seen some of the photos
yeah.
from my exhibition.
So sure.
I've had people actually say to me, did you meet all four? Did you meet the other guys too?
Yeah. You're like, yeah, see, there they are right there.
Yeah. I mean, so people can't believe, because I was with John, a lot of them have walked in and didn't even know that I lived with John. They just heard my name. They said, and it's not as easy to explain. So I said to them, maybe you should watch my documentary, because I will give you at least a base of where it's going to go. Because I had to make that at the end, and my team did an amazing job, because everybody was taking my story and telling my story without, and it wasn't the correct way. It wasn't the correct story.
That gets into the question I was just about to ask you, which is, why is it important to you that people know your story?
Well, as I always would say, you being a podcaster, say, for instance, now, and I'm going to say you did something you know that you were responsible for. Like, I've done several albums that I've been a production assistant to and all that other stuff. But you're not given the credit. You're just the sideman. But you know that you're the one who's responsible. How would you feel? Okay. Would you feel good about it? You would say, no, I created that. I did that. It was me that was there. So just because that I went out with John doesn't, why should I be, shouldn't negate all the things I did do as a person, you know, as my own job, you know? Or it's like saying, you're a mother, that's your job. That's not it.
Right.
And I have to, and you know, John was very happy and very proud of the fact that I knew a lot about music. And I was there for him on a lot of things. So why should I take a back seat when he was the one who always used to propel me to the front? And I said, are you sure? I would never take that. Because in my household, I used to say, there's one star and he's the star. I don't mind sitting in the back. But at the same time, don't take the credit away. So if I did all that work, it's like somebody said, well, whose voice is that? Oh, it's me. Oh, you know, okay. But that's known now as I didn't know that was your voice. And I love that song, right? So people love that album. I did a lot of work on that album. So why should I not get also the credit?
Right. So, and you know, so it's like, so it's 50 years now after 1975, which I find hard to believe too, because I remember, you know, I remember those records coming out in my early radio listening days. In the time that's passed since then, has there been kind of like waves of how you've felt about this? Like where sometimes you felt better about it and sometimes you were sort of wrestling with it more? Like what's your sort of path been since then?
You know, it's a bit of both. You know, life is never an easy path and say, oh yeah, I'll take this one, and it goes. I stayed out of the limelight, even though when I was, a lot of people didn't even know I was married to Tony. You know, I would just deal with whatever Tony was going on, and I was raising my kids. But you know, when things start to happen, our lives, you know, when people start talking about those records or the time period, it belonged, that's my time period. So when somebody takes it away and says, oh, I know what it was about. I've never seen so many people say, oh yeah, I was hanging out with John. And I said, who are you? I don't remember you.
Hmm.
People forgot. And there was a lot of this where people didn't even realize I was with John. So I was sitting watching from the sidelines all the time. So when they would say, oh, yeah, I was with him here. And I said, can you tell me when? I've had more women saying the same thing. And I said, tell me when. Because I could debunk anything because I'm sober. I don't drink. I don't take drugs. And I remember clearly on a few things.
Right. You were there and you remember it. So. Yeah. That's a good combination. A lot of his records have been getting re-released. Mind Games, there was just this big re-release and all these different mixes of it and stuff. I don't know if they're doing one for Walls and Bridges as well.
Well, I see we've passed the 50-year mark on that one.
Right.
That would have been last year. And so, with you know, and this year, Rock and Roll would have been now anyway. So...
What have you thought of that whole campaign? I mean, I think that that's been sort of Sean sort of remixing stuff at this point.
I don't know, because here's my feelings. He didn't know his father on this level, you know. Whatever he's doing from his perspective, not from John's perspective, you know. So I can't really speak on that. But I know what John wanted. I was there with him every day when he was in the recording studio.
Right. You know, for Mind Games as well, because you were still, I mean, you're credited on that one as well. What have you listened to these other versions of these records? I mean, I think there was a Yoko remix of it some for CD, like, I don't know, a while ago too.
Not really. I have it, but, you know, I really haven't listened to it. So I haven't had time to it, to be honest.
There you go. Like,
I know they were long.
What did you think of Now and Then and these other sort of, you know, post-Beatles recordings where they've taken demos and things that John worked on and created these Beatles quote-unquote tracks out of them?
Well, I'm going to ask this. I'm going to turn this back to you.
Okay.
Now and Then, what did you think?
I thought it was okay. I don't know. I find Now and Then to be the weirdest of them, because you have, you know, Paul is an 80-year-old singing with John, who is in his late 30s at that point, I assume. And it's just, there's something about the, I don't know. I mean, all of them. I mean, like, I'm sort of glad to have heard them. It doesn't seem like a major song. To take the sort of step back version of it, you know, to hear sort of three John songs that are all these kind of, you know, mid-tempo, dirgy sort of ballads, I don't feel like is representative of the music he was making at the time. Like, he wasn't just this balladeer, but, you know, it's sort of nice. Like the idea behind it is maybe nice, but I don't know. Now and then I just like that one. Just, it doesn't really stick to me. You know, Real Love, I remember.
I know
hearing,
you want. Yeah, I know what you're looking at. Yeah. It's,
yeah, Real Love, I remember hearing in like the, you know, Imagine documentary from. So I knew that one dated a little bit further back. Free as a Bird, I'd never heard before that version came out.
Well, you know, for me, Now and Then is a little different because I started to read the lyrics, and there were lyrics that were taken out. So when you read the lyrics, I realize John's words were like, because I said, this is so weird. I feel like this is another extension of the song Forgive Me, My Little Flower Princess, which I already knew, felt. I go, uh-oh, this is, when you're asking for forgiveness from a little flower princess, I see me in here. So, and I hear it in Now and Then. It was like an extension of it.
Huh.
Especially after I read the rest of the lyrics that were taken out.
So somewhere there's a published version that has his original lyrics, and then you can compare that to the one that came out.
Yeah.
What'd you think of the song? Like, what'd you think of the recording?
It was a very personal one. That's what I felt.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't so it was kind of weird to hear the other guys do it. I hear John.
The songs are different in different contexts, but did you have somewhat of a similar reaction, you know, whenever that was, when the anthologies came out and they put out Free as a Bird and Real Love, when actually were three of them still around to do it?
Yeah. I didn't have that same feeling at that moment, you know?
This one made you more uncomfortable.
Absolutely. There were, like I said, there were two songs. One was My Little Flower Princess and the and Now and Then.
Got it.
And it was weird because somebody else wrote to me and said, I know it's just got to be about you. I said, what do you say that? Because I didn't really realize at that moment when, you know, they were saying it. I said, why? What are you talking about? He goes, nothing is making sense. These lyrics don't make sense. You're not talking about the person. He's talking about, it's written at a time period. He's lamenting about somebody, and it's not, the person is just, is he's at home. So where is that? Who's he talking about?
Hmm. All right. I'm definitely going to have to chase that down.
How are you going to chase
you.
That
no,
down?
No, I appreciate that. That's another good insight. So this summer you have, it looks like you have various dates on the East Coast with the photo exhibit, right?
Oh yeah. We started out with 26 photographs that I had, and then now we're up to about 37, something like that. I'm very touched by, and I'm honored by a lot of professional photographers that have come out to see the show. And they all said, what training have you had doing this? And I said, why? And they said, because you got the eye to put the composition together. And I said, I've never had a training session in my life with it. I just did it by feel.
Do you still shoot a lot of photos?
Not as much as I would want to. I don't really. Nowadays, the camera is so heavy between all the stuff. And because I don't really shoot for anybody in particular, you know, professional or whatever. So I always have my phone. So right. I have to always get the top of the line phone because you can't take, you know, all the good stuff is on the top of the line. So I have to use that. And I'm still trying to learn all the stuff that they've put in for the phone. You know, it's not so simple.
When you do these appearances with your photo exhibits and you're talking to people, do these interactions energize you or do they exhaust you or all of the above?
You know what? They do energize me because they're, it answers, and I see it in their faces, all the fans, where when you talk to them and they're so wanting to know certain answers that can only be answered in a time period that I was there. And so, you know, and I talk to them and, you know, they'll come up and they'll say, can I hug you? And I say, sure. And they'll go, this is, or can I touch your hand? And they go, this is the closest I'll ever get to John, someone who touched John.
Hmm.
And it brings them a lot of joy. It brings them, you can see it in their face. You can see, you know, and they answer their questions. And when they, you know, all these people can buy, I'm now willing to share John to the public. And so when they buy a print, you can see you could see where they already know where they want to put him, you know, in the house. And you know, and I said, yeah, you could talk to him. You'll probably be surprised. You know, you probably hear him coming back to you. You know, you could see all his thoughts as, you know, you see it live and, you know, you're standing there and you could see and you could talk to him.
Yeah.
It's great. You know, and it's wonderful. Pictures of Julian and him, or everybody's been onto the Harry Nielsen, or I have one early photograph of George. And I mean, early, it is the first photograph I ever taken, of a Beatle in 1970.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was when you were working for Alan Klein.
Alan Klein and Apple, and he had just brought in his the tapes to do All Things Must Pass. And then a few weeks later, John and Yoko came in, and I took the second photo of John in his, you know, remember, it's that Lennon Remembers look, you know, that Rolling Stone where he looked very disheveled. That's the second one, and they're both in there. And he's holding his Dr. Pepper because that's what he was drinking.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'd seen somewhere there was something about, and if I have it wrong, I apologize. There's something where George and John got into some, like George pulled John's glasses off his face or something like
yes.
that.
Yes, yes. We had gone to the hotel. John hadn't seen him in a few years. And this was the Dark Horse tour. And we had gone to see him. George was thrilled to see John, and we're sitting there. And it's like a triangular thing. So George looks at John at that moment and he says, I want to see your eyes. So John takes off the sunglasses and he puts his other glasses on, of course, which is just as dark as the sunglasses. And it frustrated George for a moment. He went, oh, and he just reached over and took it off his face. He goes, I want to see your eyes.
Mm.
And he then leaned in and he just sort of looked at nose to nose into John. And John said, can you see them now? And he just sat for a second and he goes, yeah, I wanted to see them.
Wow.
And then he turns around and he goes, I'm glad you're with her. And then he looks at me and he goes, I'm glad you're with him.
Nice.
It was nice. But that was, he hadn't seen John. He wanted to see where he was at. And I guess, you know, the eyes to get into his soul, you know, it was interesting.
Well, I really appreciate you putting that in context, because you see like someone writing like, oh, George ripped John's glass off his face. It's like, oh, they're having like a conflict. But no, it was like the opposite. They were like...
Yeah.
Connecting their souls to each other through
Correct.
Their eyes.
See, this is why I'm saying why I had to, when I go out there, when people ask me, like you, yourself, just ask me that question, because I was sitting there.
Yeah.
The same thing about the documentary, why I'm doing it, because my story is taking a whole other life on its own.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Again, I really appreciated it, and it was a pleasure.
Take care.
That's all for episode 187 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to May Pang for opening up about her time spent with John Lennon and what it all has meant. The Lost Weekend, The Love Story can be viewed on demand on Amazon Prime and elsewhere. May Pang currently is touring her The Lost Weekend photo exhibition, including Friday through Sunday, June 27th through 29th, at the O Museum in the Mansion in Washington, D.C. She and the show also will be at Bridge Gallery in Cambridge, Massachusetts, July 18th through 20th, the Signet Gallery in Southwest Harbor, Maine, July 25th through 27th, and Keys Art in Sag Harbor, New York, August 1st through 3rd. You can learn more about May Pang at maypang.com and follow her on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, X, and other socials. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who will get you to listen to whatever gets you through the night. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop Conversation. Thanks.